This is George Frangoulis. This is Maine Farmstead Radio. And we have with us Ned Leitner. As I said earlier, he's a media icon here in Belfast. He has been for the last 10 or 11 years. And maybe a bit later we'll find out a little bit more about his Belfast Community Television organization, I guess I should say. He does a lot of videography in the area, and he's a man with a million ideas, as well as a million-dollar look. You're telling us about this documentary film that you helped to make and edit, and it's going to be shown at the Colonial Theater next Tuesday evening, May 23rd, and you were part of this. We mentioned earlier other musical documentaries like The Last Waltz. What were the challenges you faced when you were creating this documentary, Ned?
Well, you know, in an ideal world, the videographers are invisible. You know, you just see the musicians, you don't see any cameramen in the video. And this would have been quite plausible if they had played the way it had been originally planned, which was where the musicians were going to kind of be up on stage, like sort of like you see an orchestra, right? But because, and that was actually, that's what we were told was going to happen. But as I mentioned, these musicians, they don't play together ever necessarily, or very, you know, as a full on, they've all played together, but not necessarily all 17 at once for something like this. So it helps if you can like look at each other. So what they decided to do was to play in a circle. And so suddenly, like, okay, where are we going to place our cameras? How are we going to cover everybody? Well, we had to make kind of like a rash decision. Okay, cameramen, we may occasionally get it. We'll try to avoid each other, but we sort of need to be running around this circle covering it rather than covering it from like one angle, you know, primarily out front and getting various shots. So that was probably the biggest challenge. And just getting, not getting in the way of the magic of the event. I mean, this is a wonderful event. The videographers should be like flies on the wall, invisible. And that's sometimes challenging because you're trying to get, you know, cool and intimate. I mean, television, as my old TV teacher used to say, is a close-up medium. So, you know, those glances that a musician has toward another musician so that they know that it's time for them to take the lead, or their fingers on the accordion buttons, and getting all of that while also capturing the song itself. Now, a lot of the pacing of how the song is on the video is on the hands of the editor. But the editor has to have those pieces of the puzzle, has to have the images to work with it. And so, you know, that was live production, you know, is even though we were recording it all, it was a recording session. You know, we didn't say stop, I got a shaky camera, go back to play the beginning of it. I mean, we were there capturing the event. Now, luckily, the musicians, before they did the recording, they played the song through a few times, made a few suggestions like, why don't we start with a bum, bum, boom, beginning on the accordion or whatever. So they would kind of figure the song out and then play it a couple times. And we'd record it a couple times. So actually, when you see the documentary, it'll look like they only played the song once. But we had several chances to mm-hmm. get it together. Thank God I wasn't editing, you know. I don't know if I have the attention to detail that John has and the patience to match up. You know, everything has to be in sync and all those angles. And, you know, I'm just grateful for John Graffera, the editor, for having gone through that tedious process to create what I think is something that I feel proud to have been a part of. But, you know, not just proud to be a part of making the video, but proud to have been at that. You could tell sometimes when you're at something that it's a special event. It really was a wonderful of thing, this recording session. There was really a wonderful spirit amongst the musicians, and you could tell that the music they created was beautiful. I mean, that number that we just sort of played a clip of, I thought that was beautiful. That was actually written by one of the younger musicians. I mean, he didn't have gray hair, so I'm calling him younger. But, you know, so there's some pretty impressive composers and musicians that were part of these. Mm-hmm. But don't ask me to tell me all their names. But I wonder if, you know, I had some other clips. We can kind of, you know, bounce around on this soundtrack. Luckily, like The Last Waltz, you know, there's a lot of good music on here. So probably if we play like any place randomly, we'll come up with something and capture the flavor of the documentary.
Let's give it a shot, Ned.
Okay, do I just hit this play button? Okay, here we go. See what happens.
Okay, Colonel Robinson.
That's
three
Dudley.
Three cartoon, nothing fancy. It's sports to get it going. And
I have a suggestion.
Yeah.
The beginning?
Huh?
That's Greg Boardman.
Just a chord on the accordion.
Yeah.
I like it.
Okay, that's the way it would be anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Jimmy Shan did it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Good job, Greg.
And it ends abruptly. Are you there, George?
I'm here.
So I was going to say that, you know, we're doing Farmstead Radio. And in my mind, this music, when I first started hearing it and when it got popular again, happened around the time that the Back to the Land movement was happening here in Waldo County. You know, I remember there were communes like Twitchell Hill, and there were
a lot of us. Yeah, there were.
You know, back in the early mid-70s, you know, we felt like, wow, are there any young people around here? By that, I meant, you know, the Back to the Land young people that had moved to the area. And we felt kind of like we were this, you know, I don't know, this tribe of people that were, you know, getting back to the land and having an appreciation of music like this contra dance music. So I think, you know, this music became popular again with the Back to the Land movement.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, I moved here in 1973 and started our little farmstead, and just about the same time that Noel Paul Stuckey blew into Blue Hill with his family. He used to come down to our place. He wanted to hang around and see how it was really done, although I don't think he ever started his own farmstead. Uh-huh. But, yeah, this music fits right in with the whole feeling of back to the land and growing your own garden and raising your critters and foraging for wild edibles.
Right. Well, you know, the Nearings, who were right in Harborside, but they were kind of like, you know, the gods of the back to the land movement when I was a young guy. And they kind of divided their day up into working and I forget whether, but one of them was definitely a musical break, you know, to do music. And I remember seeing in, their book.
Living the Good Life.
Living the Good Life. They had some pictures of, you know,
Helen was the
playing
musician.
Playing music. But anyway, they believed in that kind of stuff. So it was all part of that scene. Were you around when the Red Barn had, like, Jesse Colin Young came and played at the Red Barn in Monroe?
What year was that?
I'm thinking around 74.
Yeah.
You know, that was to me, you know, a really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, you know, modern music. I mean, Jesse Colin Young, he's famous for "Come on, people now, smile on your brother." It was sort of uplifting kind of music, you know. And I remember that being a magic time in the music of, you know, this area.
Were you one of the people at Woodstock?
No, but my friend John Grafer has went to Woodstock, and he has his framed tickets because they never took his tickets.
I'll bet they didn't.
Yeah.
You know, that was in 1969.
My parents wouldn't let me go. I was, I think, you know, getting ready to go into 10th grade. My friend Duncan McIntosh was able to go. But, you know, I don't know. I would have, you know, in retrospect, I would have should have, like, you know, just gone, but you know, things you wish you had done, you know.
I know. Well, I think you've probably done a lot of things you wanted to do, haven't you, Ned?
Like, yeah, starting, yeah. Well,
how many television stations have you worked for, started?
Well, I think I've started, this would be my third or fourth station that I've started from scratch, but by this station, I mean Belfast Community Television.
Right.
But I think I've taken little stations and grown them into something completely different. So they existed. So I can't like claim that I started the station, but I definitely, you know, turned them into something else. But the first station I ever started was down in York, Pennsylvania. And I had gotten hired by a pretty big company based in York called Susquehanna Broadcasting. And I had a background, I mean, by some quirk of fate, I got like a job right out of college to run this, to be a producer for a tiny little station in Augusta, Maine. And within like 6 months, there were only a staff of three. And within 6 months, my boss got fired and I got made station manager. So at age 23, you know, I was like, I didn't know much about running a television station, but I had a lot of energy and enthusiasm, and I was willing to learn, and nothing like doing it to get a, you know, get your feet wet in this hometown community television world. And I didn't know what I was going to do in life. I mean, I had fun. Somehow I fell into television because I didn't have the patience to wait for film to get developed back when I was in college. You know, it took like a week for film to get processed. But in TV, you got video. They had, you know, they had just kind of made reel-to-reel recording relatively accessible to you, and you got that instant feedback. And when you're a beginner, you screw up a lot. So it's good to, like, see what you do and then, you know, say, okay, I won't do that again. I still managed to do it about 10 other times before I finally learned it. I'm a slow learner. But that's what got me into TV. And so then, I don't know, circumstances had it that I got hired to start a station in York, Pennsylvania. And these little stations usually work out of broom closets. I mean, if you look at Belfast Community Television, we don't even have a studio. We say the world is our studio. But I've got a really tiny tiny station slash office.
Not quite as big as the studio.
No, it's actually about half the size of this studio, and this isn't exactly a big studio. It's got a lot of stuff crammed into that room, like about four computers and workstations and stuff like that. But, you know, it's pretty small. But this Pennsylvania station, they said, we bought a high school, and you can turn the gymnasium into a studio. I mean, you know, something the size of a basketball court. I said, I'm there. I'm doing it. And my boss at the time said, he was pretty proud of the station. He said, Ned has an unlimited budget and he still breaks the budget. But, you know, we bought like a production truck from the Cleveland Cavaliers basketball facility to do our high school sports. You know, we had, we were doing a lot of fun stuff there. So that was really like my first starting a station from scratch and having the luxury of like a really big budget. But then I had a couple other operations, which were, so what happens is I get really excited. The station grows. You know, I start having like an commercial production department, a promotions department, a sports department. And, you know, of course I wanted to make this happen. But before I knew it, all I was doing was managing people.
Yes.
And, you know, I felt half the time I was being a psychologist. You know, why doesn't the guy in commercial production not get along with the woman in sales and things like that? So, you know, that usually precipitated me saying, I want to do something else. So anyway, over the years, I've started several stations. And the most recent one, which I consider my retirement station, is Belfast Community TV, which is now, I think, 11 years old.
Well, I hear you about that, starting having a creative or artistic dream, and then suddenly your creativity has to give way to managing people, and that's what happened with us out in Freedom when we were publishing Farmstead Magazine. I was running the Farmstead Press. We started a kitchen table startup, and then pretty soon we had 25 or 30 people working for us and worrying about payroll and the different departments and all, how you promote your products. And
man, I hear you. It's like the station outgrew me.
Yeah.
Well, and the station ended up doing great after I left. You know, I felt like, oh, well, when I leave, you know, it's like, what's the old saying? The graveyards are filled with people who thought they were irreplaceable. You know, I kind of felt that, oh, well, when I leave, the station can't go on. But it did go on. And, it, you know, I visited it about 15 years later, and they were playing Baltimore Orioles. Had the Baltimore Orioles baseball franchise in the town. And I'm going, oh, well, I guess they did all right.
Well, I think you helped them out. So in 2006, you started Belfast Community Television. Is that the day?
Well, I can't take full credit for it. But definitely, as you know, in almost any organization, someone's got to, like, take the ball and say, I'm going to do it. But actually, I remember Susan Guthrie was on the board, the cable board, and wanted to make and wanted to have a station happen. I wanted to make a station happen. I had been running a station in Augusta, and one of the shows I had in Augusta was with Augusta City Manager. And it turned out that years later, that city manager was city manager for Belfast. So at a crucial time when they were deciding whether they were going to let this, what had recently become a dormant public access channel, go stay dark, like Channel 5 still is, the educational channel, I presented them with the idea of creating a Belfast-based television station. And the station manager, I mean the city manager, Terry St. Peter at the time, knew that or believed that I could pull it off. And he said, well, Ned, you know, you got to form a nonprofit, but if you do that, you know, we'll try to see if we can help make this happen.
What would you like to do?
Is that me? My phone. I got to turn my phone off.
Ned just got a message from...
Tendency to, like, just play something without... I'm going to turn it off. These smartphones are outsmart me, man.
You know,
I apologize.
I was in the Belfast Library this afternoon. And I was waiting for my wife to call me. She was getting an X-ray or something at the hospital. She's fine. And the phone rang in my pocket, and I whipped it out and quickly put it on silence. And there's this woman sitting across the room. I was at the computers. And she stood up, and she shook her finger at me, and she says, "Do that outside." I won't tell you what I said. But anyway, yeah, so you've just ruined the... the whole spell here, Ned, with that phone ringing. I'm just,
I know,
shaken out of my
Yeah, where were we? We were
ecstasy.
Talking about, so Terry St. Peter said, form a nonprofit, and the city will give you some, there was actually some money set aside. The one big difference between community radio and community television is Belfast, the city of Belfast, gets what's called franchise money from the cable company that's supposed to be put aside to help run these, operate the PEG channels, the public education and government mm-hmm. channels. And so I was able to tap into some of that money to get the initial equipment. And, you know, I hate asking for money. I mean, you know, I like making programming, but hate asking for money. So we've run like a very lean operation on about $10,000 a year, maybe $12,000 when you consider the donations that just sort of roll into the station on occasion and stuff. But yeah, we've been going for about 11 years with a very modest budget. But I must say, I'm a really thrifty guy, so I love trying to do a lot with a little.
Tell us about your programs. Raining Cats and Dogs. And
yeah, that's what I was filming today. Well, you know, having started about or worked in a number of community television stations, I kind of got an idea of what, you know, some ideas that work. Of course, every community is different, but some things may work well in a number of communities. And back in 1976, when I started in Augusta, one of the shows that they actually had going was called Pet Haven Lane. And the cameraman would go out to the Pet Haven Lane, which is the name of the street, to the animal shelter and show the pets available for adoption. And so Raining Cats and Dogs is just the Waldo County version of it. Raining is spelled R-E-I, you know, like the kingdom reigning of but anyway, double entendre. But the idea is that, you know, newspapers get sold if you show puppies or little kids. So we're getting viewers because we're showing cute little doggies and kitties that are available for adoption from your local animal shelter. And, you know, that's a pretty good example of what community television could do. It can, unlike, like, radio does a lot of wonderful things, but, you know, you can't actually, you can hear, you know, meow, meow. You like the little kitty I have brought into the studio here? But wait, wait, the kitty's being eaten by a dog. You know, you could create, like, illusions on the radio, but with television, you have to, like, show, it's show and tell. So that's kind of the fun thing I like about TV. And
well,
that's
I read an old newspaper article that Ethan had written about it, I don't know how many years ago, and you were talking about the fact that by doing this, the adoption rate doubled. However, the number of pets that were brought in doubled as well.
Right, that's
true.
The strays
that were brought in.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when I started that station in Pennsylvania, I went and approached the Humane Society and I said, keep accurate records here, because the station, that, you know, in Augusta, it had been going. I had no idea of the impact of it. But, yeah, that's what happened in Pennsylvania. The adoption rate doubled and the amount of people bringing animals in. But overall, they thought it was, you know, they thought it was a good thing. I mean, you know, educating, because a show like that, besides showing the cute animals available for adoption, is also trying to give good education on, you know, the importance of neutering your pet or making sure that you don't close up your windows on a hot summer day and let Fido die, you know, in the heat. So there's a lot of good education out there that's part of it. So they, you know, these humane societies and animal shelters, they like the ongoing presence in the way of reaching out. I mean, the world is changing a lot. And back in 1976, you didn't have the internet where you could go to the city, to the website of the animal shelter and see all the animals that are currently available for adoption. So showing the pets on the TV show was, you know, probably one of the few ways you could, like, say, see what was available. But it is sort of a nice ongoing thing. And it's a pretty good example of what I think is, you know, some of the better things that community television
does. Now,
didn't
you also do a program with the Waldo County General Hospital?
Yeah, I did for a number of years. And you know, community wellness is, you know, a priority. So, you know, we would do programs about, not just like how to eat right. We usually had a cooking segment with heart healthy cooking and things like that. When the hospital consolidated and things got shifted around, they stopped doing that program. But we still show what's called wellness minutes. These are like 1 minute pieces on, you know, there's their 5210 program or their the importance of getting mammogram testing or whatever, just general good community health information. We have a lot of organizations, well, I shouldn't say a lot, but a few organizations that produce sort of short pieces, not just full-length shows. One of my favorite ones, for example, is working with Chloe Chun, who's a naturalist with the Belfast Bay Watershed Coalition. And she does a program, short segments that's called Go Wild, that encourage people to go out into the woods around them and learn about different aspects, different times of year. So, for instance, the show this time of year, we're showing, you know, a piece about spring ephemerals. Next week, I think I'm going down with Chloe to the low tide, and we're going to do five segments about things to see along the seashore, you know, learning about, let's say, barnacles or periwinkles. I don't know exactly what Chloe has in mind, but, you know, it's promoting the idea of getting out in nature. As a matter of fact, that particular series has been funded by a group. I wish I should say the name so I could give them credit. But we got a grant to do some of these segments because they are very much interested in combating obesity with low or no cost programs. And so the idea of getting people excited about exploring the world around them outdoors is something that I thought would be a natural fit, and luckily the funding organizers did.
Now, can our listeners go online and see some of these programs?
Yeah, if you go to BelfastCommunityTV.org and it says watch videos online, you can click on it. We have a Vimeo channel. People say, why did you go with Vimeo and not YouTube? And back in the day when we started it, YouTube only allowed you to put up 10-minute videos. So we had, you know, one-hour church services, and so we couldn't do it. So we started with Vimeo, and by the time we had, you know, 300 or 400 of our videos up on Vimeo, the idea of switching it all to YouTube just didn't make sense. And Vimeo is a very nice platform. It's just that people don't search things out on Vimeo. They just go to our station to watch particular programs. But if you say, look for Ned Leitner doing something, it's much, if you have stuff on YouTube, it's much more easily found.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time. We've only got a few more minutes left, Ned, and I've really enjoyed chatting with you here. We're talking about your the Belfast Community Television show. What's the future hold for that? What are you looking to do in the future?
Well, the thing I'm most excited about is that the world, you know, I've seen so many changes in television since 1976. You know, when I started, there were only like 10 channels available, and then they added like ESPN and HBO. We said, oh, that's going to be the end of community television. Or, you know, they started having VCRs. Really? Betamax. And there was I was alive when the Betamax VHS controversy was around. And they said, well, no one's going to watch community television because they're all just going to watch, you know, VHS tapes or and that didn't happen. So now they said, you know, well, everybody's going to social media and cutting the cable. And so community television is doomed. Well, I do think that the way people watch TV is changing. But the role, I think, of community media, you know, community radio and community TV is important because I think people are really interested in, you know, stuff going on around them. I mean, sure, you can have some pretty amazing stuff going on in Sri Lanka. But, I mean, the fact that the Colonial is having this cool musical event, you know, where musicians can come in and play and you can watch this documentary made by some local people, but it's a nice documentary. That's kind of a neat thing that you can do on community radio or community television. And I think more and more people are getting stuff shared on social media. I mean, I think I get a lot more views because I post stuff to Facebook, and not just our Facebook page, but if I do a program about, let's say, the country dance music, maybe Maine Fiddle Camp's Facebook page will carry it. And, you know, I think about the time I interviewed a tugboat captain and just happened to do, you know, one of my regulars somewhere in Waldo County, which is a weekly show I do. And, you know, we've got 6,000 people in Belfast, but the last time I looked, 150,000 people had watched that tugboat documentary. So, you know, the internet has created some neat opportunities for, you know, sharing what we do here in Waldo County with the world, but also being important to people in Waldo, in our community. And I, you know, when I see the bumper sticker, kill your television, I totally get it because there's a lot of trash on television. But I'm actually hoping that what I'm doing is being helpful in helping build community.
Ned, I think you're right on there. And I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about the Canterbury Country Dance Orchestra and the documentary film that will be shown next Tuesday, May 23rd at 7 o'clock. at the Colonial Theater.
Well, thank you, George, for having me. It's been a real pleasure. We've had a chance to interact in a couple different things, and I look forward to future collaborations with WBFY.
Wonderful. That's going to happen, that's for sure. And I want to thank our engineer, Doug Bacon, for helping us out tonight. George Frangoul is here. Thanks for listening. See you next time.